United States ex rel. Nathan v. Takeda Pharmaceuticals. Mr. Lamson.
Thank you, and may it please the court. My name is Jeff Lamkin. I'm here on behalf of the relator, Noah Nathan. It's not disputed for present purposes that 60 milligram prescriptions of Capidex are not medically indicated for acid reflux, also known as GERD, and are therefore false when submitted for reimbursement. The complaint in this case identifies at least 98 specific prescriptions alleged to be false for precisely that reason. For each, the complaint alleges the physician who wrote it, the month that physician received samples through Takeda sampling practices, when the prescription was written, and that the prescription was submitted to Medicare. By providing the particular prescription, the doctor, the dates, the relator has provided all the specificity, all the particularity that Rule 9b provides. The district court's mistake in this case was to conflate Rule 9b's requirement of particularity regarding the circumstances of the fraud with a rule that increases the burden of proof or burden of persuasion on showing that there in fact were false statements. But the standard rule, the rule from Iqbal and Twombly, is that the relator or the plaintiff only needs to make a plausible showing of falsity. Mere, not probability, plausibility. Rule 9 adds that you have to have show particularity on the circumstances surrounding the fraud. So you have to give specifics. But it doesn't increase or depart from the plausibility standard that otherwise applies. And
but
we can
don't you have a problem with those 98 prescriptions? Because aren't you saying that a certain percentage of them must have been for the 60 milligrams? Because the general statistics show that the Capidex was written at that dosage level, a 93% rate, so you must have had 90%. So aren't you really relying on statistics
rather than
evidence, and why not?
I think paragraph 379 of the complaint is very clear that says that each of those is a false claim. They're identified as the specific examples of false claims in this complaint. So they are alleged specifically to be false.
But you turn around and say they're not all false. Only 93% of them are false.
No, Your Honor, we suggest that we're 93% certain that each of them is false. But we should step back just for a moment.
But that doesn't demonstrate that any of them are false if you're 93% certain.
Well, Your Honor, if the government had proof that a criminal defendant was 93% certain to have committed a crime, that would meet the beyond a reasonable doubt standard, at least support a jury verdict in favor of the government.
This case is just on its face, doesn't look like a False Claims Act case. Correct me if I'm wrong. Was the company getting more money for the higher dose?
No, Your Honor. We believe we know why Takeda was pressing the higher dose, and that is that internally Takeda believed, and the documents support this, and still believes, that the higher dose, the non-medically indicated dose, is more effective for some segment of the population, and they want those sales. And it's still a false claim, even if they don't charge more, because the government does not want to pay for not medically indicated dosages, and there's a reason for that. The risks involved in double dosing people or departing from medically indicated dosages are generally higher. And the reason they're not approved is because the FDA usually thinks the risks outweigh the benefits. And this is one of those cases. When you double dose people on PPIs, particularly for a long period of time, it increases the risk of bone loss and bone fractures. And when that happens, Medicare pays.
Mm-hmm. But I thought you were alleging that the reason why they were engaging in this, at least in part, was because Prevacid was going off patent protection, and that they wanted to swallow up the part of the market.
Yes, of course, they want Prevacid was going off protection, and they wanted to position Capidex as the replacement for Prevacid, and they thought 60 milligrams.
Okay, so that's a theory of the case, but how are you alleging the false claim?
Well, the theory is that they pressed.
It's an interesting theory, interesting. But
well, actually, we think it's true because they internally believed that it was that 60 milligrams was more effective. And what they did is they promoted it as a treatment for GERD, which afflicts large numbers of people, at 60 milligrams, even though a very small portion of the population is eligible for that, because only a small portion of the population has erosive esophagitis, which is what 60 milligrams is for.
You're going to talk fast. You better talk loud.
Oh, I'm sorry.
One or the other.
I'm a bit of a fast talker. I apologize for that. And so it's a... The two pieces are, first, factually, they did in fact mislead doctors. But we don't have to show that they misled the doctors, because the gravamen of a false claim is fleecing the government, getting the government to pay for something that it shouldn't be paying for, not misleading the doctors. But with respect to the doctors, if you looked at paragraph 189 of the complaint, it explains precisely the mechanism they use. First, they're going to doctors who ordinarily don't treat EE. They're going to primary care physicians, and they're saying, we'd like you to prescribe Capidex for your patients who have heartburn. Heartburn is not EE. Heartburn's GERD. They're told to stress.
But you've got an elephant in the room here, and that's causation. I mean, these doctors aren't potted plants. You know, they're expected to review their patients. They're expected to review the medical literature and make an informed decision. And you don't have a situation here where there's a distortion of the medical literature, and you don't have a situation where you have a kickback or a, you know, classic situation of a collusion between the doctors and the manufacturer. So how do you even go about alleging causation? It seems to me that that's your biggest problem.
Well, actually, we think the causation is amply alleged for two reasons. One is we think the physicians were misled, because when a rep goes to the physician and says, I want to talk to you about heartburn, GERD. I want you to write this for heartburn. I want you to talk, and emphasizes symptom relief, which is GERD, not EE. And then he pushes across the table and says, here's the samples to use for your patients. The doctor naturally assumes these are the samples that are for GERD, not for some other much more serious condition. And the
you're assuming, as Judge Keenan just said, that the doctor's the potted plant.
Well, Your Honor, we have both the studies set forth in the complaint showing that the doctors do rely, and we also actually have the affidavits from three doctors who said they were misled, and those are incorporated in the complaint. We don't merely have our theory. We have evidence. On top of that, even if the doctors were aware, and Takeda said, we think 60 milligrams works better, and we think you should do 60 milligrams, and the doctor said, yes, you're right, I've looked at the data, it actually has more reduced plasma levels better, we think it actually functions better, I'm going to do it. But the gravamen of a False Claims Act claim is fleecing the government, not fooling the doctors.
You don't know if those doctors, if the prescriptions that those doctors wrote were submitted, and if the government paid.
Well, the answer is, we do know that for 98 of them they were submitted and the government paid, because they were submitted to Medicare. We have them listed that they were submitted to Medicare. Takeda's own records show Medicare as the Medicare Part D as the payor.
You don't know what dosage they were. You're relying on the fact that nationally the dosage in percentages skewed in your favor, but you don't know what the dosage was for these ones that were actually submitted.
We were virtually certain about the dosage. Let's set aside the 93% for the moment. The way these prescriptions are written is through something called a PPI trial, where the doctor takes the sample provided by the drug company and gives it to the patient, and the patient then tries it. And if they feel relief, then the prescription is filled. It is implausible that a doctor is taking a 60-milligram sample, using it for the trial, and then when the patient feels relief, writes a prescription 30 milligrams. And it's not merely our say-so that's implausible. The affidavit of Dr. Chang, which is Exhibit 8 to the complaint, specifically says, physicians write in the dose sample.
Does he say he did?
Pardon?
Does he say he did?
Yes, and in fact, the other three.
He did exactly what you're saying.
And Dr. Corlin,
did it consistently. He always wrote for the 60 milligram, not for the 30.
I don't know whether or not, I don't believe the complaint goes that far, but he says as a general matter, they write in the dose sample.
That is going back to the original question that Judge Keenan gave. It seems to me the problem for you is you have these national statistics and you have these local acts, and you say, because it's 93% or whatever it is nationally, that must happen locally. Do you have a case in which a False Claim Act is held to be based on that kind of evidence?
Yes, Your Honor. One of the cases we cite from the District of Massachusetts specifically says statistical evidence is good enough.
Not statistical evidence. This kind of statistical evidence. Taking the only thing you have statistical evidence about is national use, and you're saying that this also applies point by point to the local use.
I don't think we have a case that says that, Your Honor.
I don't think so either.
But the key here is our standard that we have to meet is plausibility. It merely has to be plausible. We don't have to have evidence. It just has to be plausible. Is it possible that these 16 doctors or this region is an outlier from the 93%? And that they just do things differently. We can imagine or speculate that is.
But is 9B pleading?
Yes.
But 9B does not raise the burden of persuasion or proof. It's still merely plausible It doesn't have to be probable.
But rather a substantial particularity requirement.
It's, in particular, it's the who, what, where, when, and why, which we provide, the specific ones, and I want to be clear, we allege each of those, and I would bet my house that each of those is false. I have absolute confidence because of how PPIs are prescribed, and because, in fact, I believe these prescriptions are being written by these doctors just like everybody else. But if we were wrong, if it turns out, well, one or two of them are wrong because these doctors were out of the mainstream, then we might lose at summary judgment or trial. But is it so likely that these physicians are out of the 93%, so likely that they're not doing the typical PPI trial, that it's implausible to think that these are false? It's implausible to think that these are 60 milligrams? That's not right. No, it's absolutely plausible. If it were my burden to go and exclude every conceivable possibility, every speculative alternative explanation, then we wouldn't survive. But I don't think anybody would survive on a complaint. The rule...
It is your burden to allege a false claim.
Yes, and we allege...
Which claim is false?
All 98 of them are false.
It is possible that none of them are.
The likelihood is...
I'm not talking about the likelihood. I'm talking about the possibility.
Oh, it is the most remote possibility. But is it implausible that any one of them... That if you walk down each one, you look at one, you say, is it implausible that that's a false claim? No, it's entirely plausible. In fact, we believe it's virtually certain, precisely because of the way physicians write these things, precisely because of the way that the fact that 93% of them are written that way because Takeda is sampling and promoting this for GERD at 60 milligrams. And that leads doctors to write it at 60 milligrams. When Congress has decided to increase the burden of persuasion, it does it in the text of a statute. For example, in the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act, Congress required what it said was that the facts or the circumstances raise a strong inference of a culpable mental state. Strong inference. That's the PSLRA. Now, Rule 9b doesn't do that. And the reason the PSLRA was required was because 9b itself doesn't require a strong inference. But even where the PSLRA applies, the Tell Labs decision from the Supreme Court tells us the inference of falsity, the inference of mental state, merely needs to be as plausible as competing inferences. We think the inference of each of these being at 60 milligrams is far more plausible. But that's not even our burden. Our burden is merely to allege it is plausible that one of these, and each of these, is at 60 milligrams. And I think that's absolutely clear. And I think when we get to the evidence, it will show that each and every one of these was at 60 milligrams. If there are no further questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you very much. Mr. Cavanaugh?
May it please the Court, William Cavanaugh on behalf of Appellee Takeda Pharmaceutical. This is a case in which the plaintiff has been given four opportunities to plead a cognizable claim, in which the United States has twice declined to speak on behalf of the relator. And it's because this is unlike any other False Claims Act case that we can find. There are no allegations of kickbacks to doctors. There are no allegations of phony studies being given to doctors, something that would interfere with the doctor's exercise of reasonable medical judgment as to what to prescribe for a particular patient based upon the symptoms reported by that patient. The theory in this case is that doing a lawful act, simply providing a 60 milligram sample, which is a lawful approved dosage by the FDA, somehow causes a false claim. We cannot find a single case that finds False Claims Act liability based upon that type of lawful, permissible conduct.
Well, if there was evidence that was alleged, at least in this case, that some of these local doctors did prescribe the higher dose after they got the samples, would we have a false claim then?
No, Your Honor, because that would be the physician exercising his or her medical judgment, because you have to remember the relationship. GERD causes esophageal erosion. A patient comes complaining of GERD. Unless you do a costly and invasive scope of the patient's esophagus, the physician may decide to prescribe the 60.
But I thought the plaintiff's contention was that since the only dose that is approved is the lower dose, that giving patients the higher dose counts as defrauding the government in its reimbursement programs?
Not by, that is not a false claim, because that is the physician exercising his or her medical judgment. Physicians are permitted to prescribe off-label. There is nothing inappropriate with that. What is inappropriate is when a pharmaceutical company goes to a physician and says, ignore what's in the labeling.
I'm not sure you're right about that. You think that if you they had, I don't think they do have, but if they had allegations that your client gave them these higher dosage samples, and that because of that, they regularly prescribed higher dosage labels for someone which it was not medically indicated, and the federal government said it wouldn't compensate you for it, that there still would be no false claims?
They might well have a false claim, but there would not be a claim against Takeda, because Takeda did not cause it. It's the physician exercising his or her medical judgment.
Right.
And as a matter of fact, you do not see the United States going after physicians based upon their exercise of medical judgment.
Right, but that's a different point.
It is, Your Honor.
These off-label prescriptions are not reimbursable under the federal program.
That
was what Judge Motz said.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor.
And even if Takeda has a complete intention to try to persuade doctors to prescribe at the 60 milligram level when maybe they otherwise shouldn't, or it would be off-label, by virtue of the fact that the doctor is the one who writes the prescription, completely sanitizes it and takes Takeda out of the chain of causation.
If Takeda had engaged in some wrongful conduct in order to encourage that off-label utilization, for example, the kickback cases.
Well, let's take out kickback. Let's take out exchange of money. Let's just talk about merchandising.
Fine.
This does good. This is even better than the lower dose.
Well,
costs the same amount of money.
What you have to remember, Your Honor,
is Takeda liable there for a False Claims Act?
If Takeda had promoted this drug inconsistent with the dosing information,
right,
but the very logo for the drug.
But the question I'm asking you is, what if they had done that? And your first answer, I thought, was no liability to your client. It all rests on the doctors. And now we're pressing you a little bit, and I want to know your answer.
Your Honor, had they affirmatively promoted and told physicians, ignore what's in the dosing information that we're giving you, that would be off-label promotion, and that would be that would potentially create a basis for liability. But that's not
Does
what
that
we.
Does that promotion have to all occur by explicit words, or can it occur by conduct, which is
free samples?
Here's free samples, and they're only 60 milligrams.
But the sample, again, it's left to the physician's decision as to whether to use it. The medical judgment.
It's left to the physician's decision whether to follow their sales talk, too. And you've just told us that would make out, at least for pleading purposes, a false claim.
If, in fact, they had allegations that reps were going in and telling physicians to ignore what's in the dosing card that I'm handing to you, then they would potentially have a claim here. But they don't have that. Let's remember, the district court found no misrepresentations by Takeda. They did not appeal that finding by the district court. Instead, they're trying to rest causation simply on the broad principle that making a sample available causes a false claim. Following their logic, if a company knows that there is off-label use, that company, under their theory, would be liable simply by continuing to sell the drug, because the availability of the drug is leading to a false claim. That's their theory. That's why, when you look at false claims cases that have been brought in the pharmaceutical sector, you see some misconduct on the part of the pharmaceutical company that is interfering with the physician's medical judgment. They're handing them phony studies, they're paying them off, they're encouraging them to do something that would interfere with their medical judgment. Here, there is no dispute. The very logo for the drug notes the availability of 30 and 60. The dosing card handed out lays out what the FDA-approved prescribing information is. simply providing a sample of 60 milligrams does not interfere with the physician's medical judgment.
What are the allegations about the distribution of the 60 milligram dose?
The allegation is that the 60 milligram sample was the only sample provided.
But was it mailed? Were there personal calls on the physician?
There are no specific allegations as to how they were distributed. Samples are typically dropped off at a physician's office.
Well, there were allegations, though, that they deflected questions or that they were instructed.
They came forward with an affidavit from an unnamed sales representative who said he was coached to slough off questions about the 60 milligram. However, I would point out
he give an affidavit if he's unnamed?
They put in a statement from an unnamed sales representative. You're right, Your Honor. It was not an affidavit. But the point I was getting to is that declarant never said, I adopted that practice, never said, I actually went to a physician and did what he alleges he was coached to do. Again, they lack any particularity as to this. I've been talking about causation. Let me turn to the fact of the false claim and a number of the questions the bench was asking my adversary. As to those 98 prescriptions by 16 primary care physicians, there is no allegation as to what the dose was that was prescribed. There's no allegation on the condition that was treated. They are trying to take those national statistics and foist them on 16 primary care physicians with no details as to the nature of those 16. They point to 9,000 claims. Again, no allegation as the dose prescribed, no allegation as the condition treated, no allegation as to what type of doctor prescribed them. The problem they have, they're asking this court to adopt a more lenient standard, which a few other circuits have. But when those circuits have done that, they have done it cautiously, and they have done it in instances in which courts are more comfortable allowing an inference that there was a false claim submitted because the very nature of the fraudulent scheme was directed at defrauding Medicaid or Medicare. I'll give you an example. The Duxbury case. The allegation is $5,000 was given to these providers and that they were encouraged to actually take a sample, these were physician-administered injectable drugs, and submit that free sample to the government for reimbursement. Clearly fraud. The court said, look, with those types of allegations where the very scheme itself is directed to defrauding Medicaid, the courts are more comfortable relying on statistical inferences. Another example, a recent decision in 2011 from the Southern District of Texas against Solvay was the defendant in that case. They actually took on the samples and allegedly wrote, remember, this is reimbursed by Medicaid. They targeted physicians who were Medicaid prescribers, high Medicaid prescribers. So it's inherent in the scheme that there are going to be false claims. This case does not resemble those cases at all. This is not a case in which you can take these broad statistics and then apply them to these examples. They've been given four opportunities. They don't have a single identified false claim. They speak of plausibility. That does not excuse the requirement to meet the particularity requirement of 9B when it comes to pleading a False Claims Act claim. The FCA is a fraud statute. This court in Wilson and in other cases has applied 9B to a False Claims Act case. And it requires, as this court said in Wilson, the presentation of a false claim. They do not have, they have not pled that. despite being given ample opportunities to do so by the district court. Now, they also challenge the district court's declining, giving them another opportunity to replead. It is not an abuse of discretion after being given four opportunities over multiple years. This complaint was under seal for years. They amended it twice while it was under seal. They were under no time pressures, no time crunch in order to come up with a cognizable claim. It is certainly not an abuse of discretion at this point, given the allegations they have made, putting forth a False Claims Act theory that has never been adopted by any other court, where there is the complete absence of any misconduct on the part of the pharmaceutical company that would allow for this type of False Claims Act to proceed.
Thank you very
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to start...
Why did you get another crack at amending at this point?
Well, at this point, Your Honor, we've only been dismissed once. The other two amendments were to add state law claims, so we haven't had more than one chance since the initial dismissal.
First complaint filed?
Pardon?
When?
Oh, many years back, Your Honor, but we only had notice of what the district court thought the defects were. And we put before the district court...
Often one files a complaint without knowing what the district
court
thinks
that's
the defects
right. We've had
are.
One
you try to write one that has no defects.
We do. But we got dismissed once. We had 2 weeks to fix it. The district court didn't think that was sufficient. We submitted affidavits showing what we would do to fix it. The district court said it was futile, but it's anything but futile. We can point to specific...
Well, the review there is for abuse of discretion, right?
It is, Your Honor, so long as the court is looking at the grounds the district court cited. But I'd like to start where Mr. Kavanaugh started, which was with the U.S.'s non-participation. And he asked you to draw the inference, I believe, that the United States believes this case lacks merit. But the United States has specifically responded to that kind of claim in a case called Stay versus CVS Caremark.
It doesn't necessarily mean that the False Claims Act. That's true.
Exactly.
We know that.
It says it's a totally unwarranted, inappropriate presumption is the words of the United States on that. And they go on to say maybe they have belief in the Relators Council, maybe they just have other priorities. You just can't draw an inference. But he also went on to say that, look, there's no other case where false sampling is the basis of the false claim. But the Bextra case, Your Honor, the United States itself, they filed a settlement. And if you look at the settlement, and we cited in our brief, on paragraph 64 through paragraph 69, it's all about sampling. It says, Farmacia Salesforce provided promotional samples to Bextra surgeons and other medical prescribers, had no FDA-approved use for Bextra samples, including by providing dosages that were unapproved for the usages for which the physicians were expected to use the samples. That's the settlement in Bextra itself. So this is hardly unprecedented. But I also want to go on and point out that...
Well, then we have an admission there, I guess.
Yes, that they did.
That the actual physicians that were at issue in the case did do what you're alleging these doctors did.
That it was exactly...
Well, that strikes me as a little different.
Well, and that the false scheme was actually providing people with samples that are inappropriate. But here we actually go a lot further. That Takeda didn't merely hand out 60 milligram samples and say to doctors, do with it what you will. As we allege in the complaint, it says that the target was GERD patients. Not EE patients were small, GERD patients. They're visiting physicians who do not treat EE patients ordinarily. When they visit the doctor, and this is paragraph 189, it specifically says, they're instructed, tell the doctor to try this for heartburn. That's not EE, that's GERD.
Who tells the doctor to do what?
These are Takeda's sales representatives, and these are their instructions.
This is the on-name sales representative?
No, these are the general guidance that was given to sales representatives.
Well, who said that?
Pardon?
Who says that?
This is out of Takeda's own documents, and it's in the complaint, and the court is required to accept the allegations of the complaint as true.
It's in their documents that they tell their sales representatives what?
To tell the doctor to try it for heartburn. To show the doctor a sample. What's that sample going to be? 60 milligrams. To emphasize symptom relief. Symptom relief is not EE. That's healing of erosions. Symptom relief is GERD. And then they have success stories they show on paragraphs 233 and 234.
What, you have symptoms from EE?
You do have symptoms, but when you talk about success in treating EE, you look at healing of erosions through an endoscopy, you're not talking about symptom relief generally. And that's the complaint says that as well. And again, we ask the court not to exercise medical judgment, to take the allegation the complaint is true. And if we lose on the facts, we lose. But is it plausible? Absolutely. And we, in fact, physicians are misled. We have three physicians, including an ex-president of the American Medical Association, who said they didn't even understand there was a 30-milligram dose available, and they were influenced to write at 60 milligrams because of the sampling practices and the sales pitch given by Takeda. So this isn't a case where you can just say, oh, the doctors exercised their independent medical judgment. We had nothing to do with it. Takeda cannot do an inherently wrongful, illegal promotion, pushing 60 milligrams for a non-medically indicated use, and then blame the doctors when the doctors respond predictably by writing prescriptions at 60 milligrams for GERD, which is not a medically indicated use. Even if you were to think about causation in terms of independent medical judgment of the physician, the ordinary rule is for there to be a superseding cause, it has to be not foreseeable. Here, it was very foreseeable to physicians receiving a 60 milligram dose as a sample were going to prescribe 60 milligrams for GERD when they are given that sample and told this is for GERD. It is not only predictable and foreseeable, it was the intended outcome here. And again, in terms of influencing physician judgment, we believe, we will prove, and the complaint alleges and identifies specific physicians who were fooled. And we think all of them, frankly, were fooled, except the ones who don't get samples. But even if we couldn't, as the court pointed out, if Takeda merely has an unlawful promotion and convinces the physicians to write the prescriptions at 60 milligrams, which is not a medically indicated dose, and the physicians just agree with it, that is still causing the submission of a false claim. There's no requirement of an intervening misstatement or any false document in between. Simply causing the submission of a false claim is a violation of subsection A1A. And you can also tell that from the text. The False Claims Act has a second section which requires a false statement or a fraudulent document in connection with a false claim. That's sometimes referred to as the double falsity requirement, false statement and false claim. But the first subsection, A1A, doesn't require it. It merely requires causing the submission of a false claim. We have 98 specifically identified prescriptions. We have excellent reason to believe that every one of them is 60 milligrams, and every one of them was not for EE because they were written by primary care physicians who do not treat EE because EE is a very rare condition compared to acid reflux. We have every reason for people to draw the reasonable inference that these were false. As long as that's plausible, we're entitled to get to the next stage. And this court has pointed out in Harrison that the purpose of the specificity requirement is, one, give the other side notice so they can write a defensive pleading, so they can write an answer, and two, to show that we have substantial pre-discovery knowledge, that this is not a fishing expedition. This is not a hazarding a guess. We know, and we have given in the complaint good reason to believe that every one of those 98 is a false claim. Accordingly, we believe that the judgment of the district court should be reversed. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. We will come down and greet the lawyers and then go directly to our next case.